Welcome to Chapter 11. Can't believe it's almost at the end of the semester. Time goes so fast. Chapter 11 is entitled Regulation of the Electronic Media. The electronic media is comprised of anything that you got to plug in to use. So anything like a television or a radio or a cell phone, although we're not going to talk a lot about cell phone regulations. Your internet access, of course, that's electronic media. However, there are different kinds of electronic media. When I talk about broadcast in this class, I'm talking about over-the-air, TV, and radio, right? So anything that's free when you plug in your radio or you plug in your TV set, ABC, NBC, the free over-the-air network stations and the free radio. I'm not going to be talking about cable, which has fewer regulations, or satellite, because those are subscription models and the government stays out a little bit of those. But broadcast media is regulated quite a bit, and we'll talk about why that is in a few minutes. I'd like to start out by talking about five models of First Amendment regulation. I'm going to start out with the print model. The print model is typified by newspapers or books, magazines, anything that's printed on dead trees. The government tends to stay out of content regulation in the print media. The idea is that individuals have the right to speak their minds here. There's an open marketplace, and success is measured by the marketplace of ideas. Good ideas will succeed, bad ideas will fail. So there's not a whole lot of regulation on print media. Okay, contrast that with broadcast. Broadcast is regulated more heavily than print is. I'm going to say that again. Broadcast is regulated more heavily than print. That's an important concept, and I'll return to it again and again. Why is that? You might think that's kind of unfair. I'm inclined to agree with you, but you know, you don't have to agree, you just got to know. Broadcast is regulated more because the electromagnetic spectrum, the airwaves, are a public resource. We own them, right? Just like we own the oceans and the rivers and the forests. They belong to the public at large. So as a result, if somebody wants to use those resources to make money, the government has to regulate them. We'll talk a little bit about that in a few minutes. There is also an issue of scarcity, licensing, all right? Broadcast spectrum is only so big. If you've got a recent copy of the book, you can see in Chapter 11 the broadcast spectrum, all right? It's a fairly limited spectrum. It can only be so big. Physics says it can't be any bigger. So when it's gone, it's gone. So the government has to regulate this scarce resource. As a result, the government regulates in something called PICON, Public Interest, Convenience, and Necessity. I'm not exactly sure. I can't really define for you what public interest, convenience, and necessity means. All I can do is give you examples of it, and this whole chapter is full of examples of broadcasters' need to serve the public interest. Okay? Political broadcasting serves the public interest by telling us how, you know, what the positions of these candidates are. Indecency serves the public interest by making sure little kids don't get hit with indecent speech, etc., etc. And we'll talk more about that as we get deeper in. The government has said over and over that the right of the public to hear diverse viewpoints is very important. We'll talk about that in Red Line in a minute. All right? Financial success is important, but not wholly the reason for the existence of the broadcast media. Again, serving the public interest is the most important. Licensees are responsible for content, and the FCC that we'll talk about, the Federal Communications Commission, is responsible for reviewing and regulating. All right? Broadcast is regulated more than print. You don't have to like it. You just got to know. All right, a couple other models you should be aware of. The monopoly model. Okay, when I pay my cable bill here, I live in Garden Grove, I pay Time Warner Cable because that is the franchise that serves my city. Why is that? Well, it's really expensive to dig holes for cables to serve my house with cable. Okay, we're setting aside Fios and those other, you know, wireless kinds of things that go on. Monopoly model says that one organization serves one community, at least in this area. And the government has pretty much said that this is okay because of the high expense of permitting competition with different cities. It's expensive to provide cable access to a city. And so most cities contract or franchise with one organization. And that's the organization that serves the entire city. The FCC does regulate rates. And because it's a subscription model, a lot of the content regulations don't apply. We'll find that in indecency and political broadcasting in particular. The FCC is also permitted to review, however. Right? The fourth one is called a common carrier. All right? Telephones, which is the example I give you here, should be considered to be a public utility, sort of like heat and water and electricity. Every household in the United States is supposed to have telephone service. It's called universal service. Every single household in the United States is supposed to be able to get what they call POTS, plain old telephone service, the ability to call 911 and make basic phone calls. Right? That's called universal service. But the government does not generally regulate the content of what comes over the telephone. As we talked about in earlier chapters, the phone rings and you pick it up and it might be your mom, it might be your boyfriend or girlfriend, husband, wife, or it might be an obscene phone caller, or maybe even worse, a telemarketer. Okay, forgive me if you're a telemarketer. But many people consider them to be obscene, not in the legal definition. However, the government sends them all through regardless. Okay? Rates can be regulated by the FCC, and the FCC does review telephone, although we're not going to spend a lot of time on telephone law at all. Finally, there's a fifth model called the Internet model. Notice I put still developing. That's because it is. Generally speaking, government has been very reticent to regulate the Internet. It's regulated the Internet more like a book than like a television set, which is kind of good for development of the Internet in, you know, the view of First Amendment liberals like me. I kind of like to see less regulation, not more, but your mileage may vary. Would not hurt you at all to know these regulations. There have been questions on the final exam, these models. Right? Now I'd like to talk to you a little bit about regulations. There are three kinds of regulations. We're going to spend most of our time this chapter talking about only one. Technical regulations are regulations that regulate the technology and how the technology works in the media. So, for example, the reason that you and I could talk to each other on the phone is because the government has regulated how the phones can talk to each other, the frequencies on which the waves can travel, how the technology works. When I bring home a new television set and I plug it into the wall and I'm able to get free programming, CBS, NBC, ABC, that's because the government has regulated how it all works. TV picture standards, frequency regulations, all of those are technical regulations. We're not going to spend a lot of time this chapter talking about technical regulations because most of the time they don't have First Amendment implications. Second kind of regulation is structural regulation. These are guidelines for how businesses work with each other. Ownership regulations are an example of structural regulations. Those sometimes have First Amendment applications or implications, but because of the time frame of this class and the fact that we don't have as much time as I'd like, we're not going to talk a lot about structural regulations. The Telecommunications Act of 1996 that we'll talk about in a few minutes does have guidelines on ownership. It changes and regulates the number of businesses that can be owned by one company, for example. And as I said, there are First Amendment implications because of organizations like Clear Channel. Those of you who are familiar with Clear Channel know that they own an awful lot of radio stations around the country. The Telecom Act permits this to happen. Some people think that's a massive failure on the part of the Telecom Act. In any event, there are First Amendment implications, and if you're interested in that, take a look at Chapter 12 in the book, which talks about some of those. We're going to spend most of the time this chapter talking about content regulations, regulations that regulate the content of the messages that are distributed through the electronic media. Okay? Would not hurt you at all to know this for the final exam either. All right, let's turn toward the most important slide in this whole darn chapter. This is why broadcast is regulated more than print. You might be mad about this and think it's unfair. I'm inclined to agree with you, but you and I aren't in charge yet, and when we are, maybe we'll change it. Broadcast is regulated more than print for a bunch of different reasons. First of all, as we mentioned, broadcasters use the airwaves, which are a public resource, to generate revenue. We own the airwaves. The public does, like we own the oceans and the public roads and all that stuff. They belong to us. So if a broadcaster wants to use that public resource to make money, the government steps in and makes them a trustee. In other words, they're supposed to take care of that public resource and use it in the public interest, convenience, and necessity, or PICON. Okay? So that's why broadcasters are given additional regulations on what they can do with that to make money, because the government is permitting them to use public resources. Right? Couple other reasons. The airwaves are scarce, as I mentioned a few minutes ago. The broadcast spectrum can only be so big. It can't be any bigger, because that's physics, and you can't change the laws of physics. Okay? Theoretically, not everyone who wants to use the resource can use it, so the government has to step in and license the use. One other thing that goes along with this is, should probably be on this slide, but isn't, is the idea of chaos on the airwaves. Right? Early on in the development of the broadcast industry, radio in particular, you know, broadcasters broadcast anywhere they felt like it. So I would turn on my radio to the same station every day, and one day I might get opera, another day I might get jazz, another day I might get talk radio, and another day I might get static. Government loves consistency. So to regulate the chaos of the airwaves, government decided to step in and regulate. And finally, and I would argue probably the most important, is protecting of children. Broadcast media are intrusive and pervasive. Let me give you an example. I have a nephew in my house. His name is Liam. Well, he's not in my house. He's my brother's son. He's a little rock star. He's 4 years old, very precocious. He knows full well how to turn that TV set on. And whenever he pushes those buttons to turn the TV set on, he gets bombarded with whatever is on the screen, whether that is Barney or Debbie Does Dallas. It doesn't make any difference. Whatever is on the screen at the time, he gets hit with. Okay? Government has children too, right? Congress people have children too, FCC commissioners. They don't want little kids to be bombarded with bad images. They want to be sure that when little kids are in the audience, they're protected. Okay? And finally, Liam, although he's a very bright young man, pretty much does not pick up the New York Times and read it on a regular basis. Little kids can't access print media in the same way they can access broadcast media. Broadcast media are intrusive. They come into your home. They're pervasive. They slam you in the face. And that's why they're regulated. This is probably the most important slide of the whole thing because it establishes why broadcast is regulated more. You don't have to agree. Just got to know. All right. Let's turn to the reason or some of the law that supports these double First Amendment standards. Again, I'm not thrilled about this either, but this is the way the law is. Red Lion is a really important case. The Red Lion Broadcasting Company was challenged under a law called the Fairness Doctrine. We'll talk more about the Fairness Doctrine a little bit later on. But the Fairness Doctrine said, when it was in force, that broadcasters had to invite individuals who were on different sides of a public controversy, cover that public controversy from all sides equally. So, for example, if I'm an owner of a broadcast station, I would have to invite somebody in who was against looser immigration policies and somebody who was for looser immigration policies and let them fight it out on air so that the public can be informed. Now, as you might guess, not many broadcasters participated in this because wouldn't you rather watch America's Greatest Car Chases 12 than watch two people arguing about the state of immigration? You know, even a dork like me probably would. So many, many people, many, many broadcasters pretty much ignored the Fairness Doctrine. Red Lion had ignored it, and it was brought to court and said, well, this is an unconstitutional regulation on us. And the Supreme Court said, no, it's not. Broadcasting is intrusive and pervasive. It's a scarce resource. It's a public resource. And it is the right of the viewers and listeners, not the right of the broadcasters, which is paramount or most important. Okay? So the First Amendment doesn't stand in the way of additional regulations on broadcast, right? Again, if you're a broadcast journalist or if you're interested in making stuff for broadcast in PR or advertising or entertainment, you're thinking, well, this isn't really very fair. I don't love it either, but that's the way the law is. You don't have to agree, right? Following that was a case called the League of Women Voters. League of Women Voters was a challenge to a law that said that public broadcasting stations were not permitted to editorialize on issues of public importance under the Fairness Doctrine. The court said, well, we don't like this. We're uncomfortable with this. And again, this is some years after Red Lion. We really don't like the idea that there are content restrictions on broadcasters on First Amendment grounds. So really, we're not really thrilled about this whole Fairness Doctrine thing. And maybe we ought to have another case. Again, we're talking about 1984, after 1969, to really invite review of the Fairness Doctrine. So before that could happen, the Fairness Doctrine was actually abolished. So in summary, we no longer have the Fairness Doctrine. The Fairness Doctrine was done away with, and we'll talk a little bit more about that a little bit later on, in 1987 by President Reagan. However, if it were brought back today, it would be constitutional under Red Lion. So Red Lion did a couple of things. The importance of Red Lion is that it upheld the constitutionality of the Fairness Doctrine, and it sort of supports this two-tiered system of regulation. We call it the Red Lion Standard. Okay? Contrast that with Pat Tornillo. That sexy young man there is Pat Tornillo. He was running for state legislature in Florida. The Miami Herald was not fond of Pat Tornillo and wrote an editorial saying don't vote for him. Florida at the time had a law called a right of reply law. which means just as it says. Somebody who has been attacked in the newspaper has a right of reply. So Pat Tornillo wrote a response to the editorial and submitted it to the Miami Herald, said, publish this under the law. Miami Herald said, not only no, but hell no. Tornillo sued. The Florida Supreme Court upheld the right of reply law, and the U.S. Supreme Court said, what are you smoking, and unanimously overturned it. The U.S. Supreme Court said that the government is not permitted under the First Amendment to tell a newspaper publisher what it can and can't print. Right? Newspaper hands off for the government. And again, they had just said in Red Lion, newspaper or broadcast media hands on for government regulation. All right, so there is a different level. There is no guaranteed right of access to the print media, unlike the electronic media, which we'll talk about when we talk about electronic broadcasting of political ads. But the Tornillo standard is that government cannot get involved in print. All right, I will call this the Tornillo standard, because that's what most First Amendment scholars call it. It's different from the Red Lion standard for broadcast. All right, so Tornillo says the government is not permitted to tell a newspaper what it can print. The Red Lion standard says that the rights of the viewers and listeners are more important than the rights of the broadcasters. It's a completely separate two-tiered system. Don't have to agree, just got to know. All right, let's turn to a few regulations from the earliest days on of broadcast media. Okay, here's Rose. Oh, Jack. Here's Jack. Oh, Rose. He's dying so beautifully. I'm going to give away the plot. Of Titanic, the ship sinks. It sank in 1912. During the Titanic disaster, 1,000 people or more died. There were two ships who could have come to help. One ship was farther away. The wireless operator heard the distress calls and started speeding toward Titanic to save people. The closer ship, the wireless operator had gone to bed. Okay, so that party, if that person had been awake and had been able to send the ship to help out, a lot fewer people would have died. After the Titanic disaster, large ships were required by the Radio Act of 1912 to have 24-hour wireless connections so as to avoid disasters like this. Fast forward 15 years or so, and broadcast is starting to be a really important mass medium, okay, particularly radio. Television was still a few years out yet. As a result, Congress passed the Radio Act of 1927, largely because broadcasters were being very chaotic about where they broadcasted their works. The Radio Act of 1927 created the Federal Radio Commission and gave that commission the ability to license broadcasters to stay on particular frequencies and to allocate frequencies among the broadcasters and for different government and private uses. Okay? Fast forward another few years. And the Communications Act of 1934 is passed. This is still good law today. We're going to talk about some cases that interpret it a little bit later on. It's been amended a number of times. However, it created the Federal Communications Commission and enabled the FCC to regulate in PICON, again, the public interest, convenience, and necessity. The FCC has broad regulatory powers assigned to it by the COM Act of 1934, but it is not permitted to censor. In other words, it's not permitted to stop broadcast from happening. Generally speaking. Okay? The other major act I need you to know about is the Telecommunications Act of 1996. It's a huge omnibus update to the 1934 Act. It is supposed to promote competition and reduce regulation in order to secure lower prices and higher quality services for American telecom consumers, blah, blah, blah. Depending on who you talk to, it's either a wild success or an abject failure. Your mileage may vary. Some of the things it did, it deregulated the telecommunications industries and permitted them to develop in areas that they might not have otherwise developed in. Okay, so cable can offer internet, internet can offer cable can offer telephone, telephone can offer internet. All of those convergence, which we'll talk about in a minute, are permitted by the Telecommunications Act. Also set the stage for what is called one-stop shopping. If you pay one bill for telephone, internet, and cable, you have a bundle. That was permitted by the Telecommunications Act of 1996. Okay, prior to that, you had to pay separate bills, and many organizations were not permitted to offer different kinds of services. All right, some people really like the convenience of paying one bill. Some critics suggest that the convenience might override consumers' general desire to try to get the best price. Because if it's really convenient to pay one price, you might not realize that a competitor is offering lower rates. Okay? Cross-ownership is now permitted. We're not going to talk a lot about the cross-ownership issues, but suffice it to say that many telecommunications organizations have gotten bigger and bigger by buying each other up. Okay? One commentator calls it the trend toward bigness. The idea here is that in order to innovate, companies have to get bigger and bigger so they have more money, and as a result, the telecommunications companies are being permitted to buy each other up and to buy up smaller ones. Clear Channel is one example. Some people think that Clear Channel Communications, the fact that one organization owns so many radio stations all over the country, is indicative of the failure of the Telecom Act, but your mileage may vary. Again, the idea was supposed to be more possibilities toward competition, depending on who you talk to. That may or may not be the case. Convergence, however, has happened, the ability of companies to get into each other's industries. Time Warner Cable, that I pay a bill to, I pay a bill for my internet service and my cable TV to one company. It's bundled. I don't do phone through it for a number of different reasons, but I do have a small bundle, and that was permitted because of the Telecom Act. The Communications Decency Act, most of which was overturned in a case we're not going to talk about, had to do with regulating pornography on the Internet. Basically, it's overturned. Pretty much you can have pornography on the Internet, as you probably have guessed. The VCHIP we'll talk about later in this chapter is also part of the Telecom Act, as well as Section 230, the issue of the elimination of liability for ISPs for third-party libels that we talked about in Chapter 4 was also part of this. So the Telecom Act did this and a whole bunch more. I wouldn't suggest you read it because it's pretty darn boring. But there it is. Okay, let's talk a little bit about our friends at the FCC. Since 1934, the fine-looking gentleman with the deep dimple in his chin at the top of the page is Julius Genachowski. He is currently the chairperson of the Federal Communications Commission. He, along with all of the others, were appointed by the President, confirmed by the Senate. They serve for 5-year terms, which are renewable. Copps and McDowell have served for multiple terms. Genachowski, Copps, and Clyburn are the Democrats. Baker and McDowell are the current Republicans, because only 3 commissioners can only come from one political party. So under George Bush, there were 3 Republicans and 2 Democrats. Under Obama, of course, there are 3 Democrats and 2 Republicans. And they have a whole lot of powers. They make and enforce policies, including indecency, which we'll talk about later on in this chapter. They grant due process, which means that they have to permit the public to comment when different rule changes are made. We'll talk about what that means a little bit later on as well. We'll often see FCC versus somebody or somebody versus FCC because the courts are permitted to review their decisions. They have to go to court to defend them sometimes. They are responsible to Congress, so Congress also gives them additional rules. And they do a whole bunch of other things. They're the person to whom license applications come. They get complaints, including indecency complaints that we'll talk about later on. They conduct investigations. They implement regulatory programs, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. They are the primary executive body responsible for regulating the electronic media, including large portions of the Internet. And many people don't even know their names, but at least now you've seen their names and their faces, and you know kind of who these people are. Really kind of important for being not very high profile in our government.